Okay, good morning. Today is Wednesday, April 16th, 2008. My name is Allison Page and I'm with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. And today I will be interviewing David Green with the Forest Products Lab. Mr. Green, if you want to start by kind of talking about your academic background, professional background, any early history that would be applicable to why you came to the lab and how you found out about it?
Okay. Well, I have a bachelor's and master's degree in wood science and technology from West Virginia University and a PhD in organic material science from Syracuse. And then, so that gave me training in this field directly. Kind of a hybrid between engineering and wood. And I worked for 5 years in industrial research in Canada in a suburb of Montreal, Quebec. I was a college professor, assistant professor at Virginia Polytechnic Institute for about 2 years.
Around what time period is this?
I came here in January of 79, and so for the couple of years before that I was at VPI. In Canada before that. And I did learn to speak French. Trouble is I had such a southern accent, nobody could understand me, so. I was therefore extremely aware of the lab before I came here. And in some of the conferences I would attend and things, I actually had met 7 or 8 of the scientists from the lab. So I knew a few people. It turned out, although I didn't know it at the time, there were a couple of employees here who graduated from West Virginia University, one of which I'd been a lab partner with in a class, so didn't know he was here. So to me, coming to the lab was a desirable thing to do, and that's the reason I came here, was I had an opportunity to work here at FPL.
Who kind of introduced you to the position that you applied for here at the lab?
I got a phone call from a fellow who was the what we call project leader at the time. I had met him a time or two. I had sort of let some folks in the Forest Service know that I was interested in working here, so you know, sort of word of mouth sort of thing. And he called me up and said he had a job that I might qualify for and would I be interested in. Explained it a little bit over the telephone, and I was a professor at VPI at the time, and he was going to be in D.C., so he said, I'll come down there. So he came down and interviewed me. So I arrived here as a new employee, having never seen the place. So what else would you like to know?
Well, could you maybe describe your first day on the job, first couple weeks, months, the first year or so, and the division that you worked in?
I was part of a larger group, assistant director area. It basically was generically called engineering. Its actual title changed over the 27 years I worked here and changed before that, but it's still more or less the same thing. So it was groups of projects, of research work units that dealt with various aspects of engineering, from structures to material properties and so forth. And my first official day at work was January 1st of 79, which is a federal holiday, so I started off on holiday the first day. Came the second day, and of course they take you in, and I was, visually I was impressed by how long and linear the hallways were. They had just row after row of offices and so forth. But at the same time, I was very impressed about how organized they were. They were ready for me to show up. They had certain things that I needed to do, some of which is the mountains of routine paperwork, but other things more or less is orientation. And that continued probably for the next month or two. And so they knew exactly the sorts of things that they wanted me to be involved in, and had meetings to explain that and met people I'd be working with and so forth. And so I was really impressed that they were organized and knew what they were doing. I was very impressed with the mountains of paperwork you had to fill out, but I kind of expected that from the federal government. So. got to meet some of the people that I didn't know but had heard of, and that was good also. I was hired to work on a very specific project initially, which is generally known as the in-grade testing program. It was a new program cooperative with the lumber industry in the U.S. and Canada to come up with a total new basis for assigning allowable properties to lumber. And it was a very large program. Although I worked under the project leader for that particular project, and I had others, I reported to his boss. And so there was a little, you have to be careful not to slight one versus the other. So, but they got along okay, so it worked fine. And certain parts of the program most of the program actually was yet to be defined. So there were a lot of meetings with the industry folks and so forth. And fairly early on, I was never expected to be able to grade lumber, but I needed to understand how to do it. So. In the winter of 79, they sent me to Duluth, Minnesota for a week for training.
A little cold there.
Everybody felt very sorry for me because they knew I came from Virginia. Mm-hmm. What most people didn't know is I spent 5 years in Canada. They get 300 inches a year. Mm-hmm. They get about 150 inches average. So, mm-hmm. So until this year, that had been our previous record snowfall winter. Mm-hmm. So. They did have orientation programs about the lab. They had orientation programs about the Forest Service, and therefore a little bit about USDA, mainly how it fit in. And so I was initially had a very favorable impression that here were folks that knew what they were doing. They were connected up with other good groups of people, both mm-hmm. academic research people and industry. And it fit the impression I had of the lab before I came, so.
Great.
I'm just reading through your questions here. You said describe a typical day. There's no such thing as a typical day here. It's a lot like a college professor. You'll spend an awful lot of time doing desk work. It may be writing, it may be analyzing data, it may be having meetings and talking to people. But you also had the opportunity then to go out and travel, and sometimes budgets were better then, and they would send us out sometimes for travel, for orientation. Send you to a sawmill, send you to a manufacturing facility. Meet people in the forest and so forth, as well as things that are related directly to whatever you're working on. Mm-hmm. So it was a really nice kind of introduction. And I came to like the opportunities to go out and, work in a mill mm-hmm. or a forest or something.
What kind of place? Where? Throughout the country or internationally?
Internationally, really. I basically had studies all over the United States. Now, what tends to happen because of the objectives of a particular program you're working on, or the Forest Service, or even USDA, you may go to one particular part of the country a lot for a few years, and then you may not be back there again for a number of years, and you're in someplace else, so it varied. But over the course of my career, I was in virtually every state that has a forest. And interestingly, some of the things that I remember about those are not necessarily the research study itself, but the places you got to go mm-hmm. and so forth. In this initial in-grade testing program, The locations would vary when we meet with the industry folks. Sometimes they would come here. Sometimes we would go to the south someplace. We'd go out west to Portland, Oregon or someplace. And so they'd be moved around so nobody had to do all of the traveling and so forth. Those, although I got to travel a lot, I also mainly saw the inside of meeting rooms and so forth. But as we, you know, after about the first year, we got more into the testing sort of phases. And then I would be out with some of the industry people making sure that we mutually understood exactly how the program was working and so forth. And they'd have training for the people. Industry supplied most of the testing for that program, to make sure they understood how they were supposed to do the testing and so forth. And so that might involve going for a week or two. And sometimes you'd be all in one place for a week, and sometimes you'd be in a different place every day for a week. Mm-hmm. And so initially I did a lot of traveling for that sort of stuff. Another program I worked on later dealt with improving the structural grading and properties for hardwoods. Hardwoods in the United States for like houses and so forth have not been used a whole lot. They've been used more for large structural members such as in railroads or something. But we had opportunities to go to central West Virginia, go to a little town of maybe 2,000, drive over to a mill that's 10 minutes out of town, work all day there, really get to know the problems directly of the people that you're trying to help. This is not a place that sort of, you know, somebody tells you a problem and you go work on it. You actually go work with these folks. Mm-hmm. And they'd be very interested, all the way from their technicians up to the company president, who'd sometimes come down and meet with us and talk to us. Mm-hmm. And going out with some of your colleagues and some of our technicians in our testing lab, you know, was also a great opportunity to get to know them a lot better. And we often put in long days. Basically, we followed the schedule the mill would have. So if they started work at 7 in the morning, we were there at 7 in the morning. If they quit at 5, we quit at 5. If they quit at 7, we might quit at 7. You didn't want to interrupt their schedule. So you put in long days, and that was fine. You didn't bother us at all. And often, in some of these situations, over a period of a year, you might go back there 2 or 3 times, so you got to know the area a little bit. In my case, I'm from West Virginia, so for that one, I already knew a lot about it. But, mm-hmm. you know, you get to know those local restaurants that are good and mm-hmm. things like that. had a chance to go to Alaska on several studies at the request of the Forest Service in Alaska. In fact, they paid for some of the trips. And so probably I've been to Alaska 9 or 10 times, at least 3 of which were on research projects, nothing less than a week, sometimes up to 2 weeks. And usually not in the tourist season. Luckily in southeast Alaska, it's a rather mild climate, not like what we anticipate for the interior of Alaska, but also very rainy and so forth. So I can remember being climbing up mountains that you almost had to go up on your hands and knees to go up in order to locate some trees and cut down and roll down the hill to a truck so they can be shipped back here for testing. Mm-hmm. Some of these places, there's maybe only one place in town that you could stay. And we were at Wrangell Island and got to stay at a lodge that basically was closed. I think there was only one other guest there for one night. The rest of us, there was 3 of us there from the Forest Products Lab. Mm-hmm. And so the owner would come out. He was the owner was also the cook, and he'd cook, and we'd come back and shower and, you know, eat. And later, the director of the lab at that time, and this is back at the time of the spotted owl, during the Clinton administration, and the Forest Service was directed to stop timber harvests, which had a great impact on a lot of these communities because that was their primary economic base. And they begun to look at the Forest Service as the problem. In other words, we simply were the people that were giving them what the administration had decided, but we were on the ground with them. So the Forest Service often got kind of a bad name because of that. The Forest Products Lab came in and tried to help them say, okay, are there some forest-based alternatives you could do? Are there some mills that are still here that perhaps could benefit for some improved technology or some increased efficiencies and so forth? So we would go, let's say, to Alaska, and we go to Wrangell Island, and there'd be a meeting scheduled, and people, both Forest Service people, industry people, and town people could come, and we'd give them a little presentation to tell them who we are, the kinds of things we might be able to help them with, the kinds of things we couldn't help them with. We didn't have a pot of money. We were not there to give you money and so forth. And we'd have discussions of things. And as often happens in the academic world, sometimes maybe half the questions you get are things that are known. It's just that they don't know them. Mm-hmm. So we could help them out by just supplying them information. But there were a number of good research studies that came out of that too. And we got to help out some of those folks. And I participated in about 6 or 7 of those over about a 3-month period in Alaska. Mm-hmm. We did the same thing down in the continental United States, in Oregon and Idaho, and you know, sort of in the West. And I thought it was a really good opportunity for us to learn a little bit more about the problems of small companies, in particular towns that have ideas of things they might want to do. It was an opportunity for them to see a portion of the Forest Service that wasn't just telling them that you can't do this, mm-hmm. whatever this is. Mm-hmm. it also got us a lot of favorable input from the Forest Service itself, from the National Forest System. And in the process, we even got recognized by some governors and senators and so forth. So. So I thought it was a really nice experience to be able to go out and do that.
So would you say that your reception by the industry was in general favorable?
Yes.
And then
by the industry was always favorable. Mm-hmm. Mostly it was favorable by the townspeople once they kind of understood who we were and who we were not. But. Some communities had put a lot of thought into what they might want to be doing, and some were just barely starting. Depending on their level of knowledge, we could either tell them where to go to begin to collect information, or if they'd pretty well decided an area, somebody wanted to open a new mill of some kind and so forth, we could help them with providing information or where to get information on equipment and contacts and maybe some opportunities that weren't things that were known in the area. It might be something that was being done down in southern Oregon, but the folks up in northern Montana didn't know that you could even do this. Mm-hmm. And so basically I think our reception was very good. Towards the end of my career, I was doing a lot of work on properties and uses of small diameter trees. There's a tremendous number of small diameter trees that need to be removed from the forest in the West in order to reduce the fire hazard, to make the forest more healthy. The forest is a living organism, and it is young. It has weird young trees have weird properties, sometimes like young people do. Then they get old, they just might have other kinds of problems. And in the West particularly, they were used to using much older, larger diameter trees. And so it was surprising what was not known about the properties of some of these smaller diameter trees. And so some of what we were doing was basic research, some of it was more applied research. And often, because it was convenient, we would work with university departments. So if there was some testing needed, we would cooperate with them and get the testing done there. Some of the testing was done here, but often be done there. Mm-hmm. And Professor Tom Gorman at the University of Idaho is one I've done a lot of work with. In fact, I still have some projects with Tom. But I can remember going out to southern Idaho, and we had to go up and take measurements on quite a number of trees and some small diameter stands. And then a certain number, 20 or 30, had to be cut down and brought back for further evaluation at the lab. And we were in places that the general public does not normally get to. You know, the Forest Service and National Forest, in order to prevent theft and so forth, they have a lot of locked gates. Well, we had a master key. So we would drive up into the Rockies, you know, every day. And I can remember sitting up there one day on the side of the hill, about two-thirds of the way to the top, and you had this great view down the valley, and we're having lunch. Well, it turns out there's a bear up behind us, and she's up there. Maybe she's having lunch too, I don't know. But she could hear us, and we could hear her, but she didn't bother us, and we weren't about to bother her, so... So sometimes, although the research was the important stuff, sometimes what you remember is the experiences like that. Mm-hmm. Tom has a cabin over there, and three or four times when I've been out on trips, I've spent the weekend with him or taken a couple of days vacation, and we've stayed at his cabin and gone trout fishing and stuff like that. Ooh. So I've had a lot of foreign travel. Again, sometimes your foreign travel is more meetings than you'd think. One of the unique pieces of foreign travel that I went to a conference in East Germany. This was when the European Union was in its early stages of formulating what today we would really view. They've had these plans for a long time, but for a long time they were just on paper. Mm-hmm. And this conference was set up, it was an international conference in wood engineering, and it was set up to share information between the East and the West. So there were Russians there and East Germans, as well as all the European countries and so forth. And I had a chance to fly into East Germany, and it turned out I was in East Germany about a month before the wall came down.
Oh, wow.
And to get to East Germany, I had to go to Amsterdam. I was not allowed to go to West Berlin and cross the border.
Oh, really?
The East Germans were giving Americans, especially Americans on official passports, a lot of hassle. They just delay you all day before they let you through. Mm-hmm. So I flew to Amsterdam and then got on East German Airlines, Interflug it's called, and flew directly into East Germany. That was kind of interesting. You know, they have had a so-called classless society. Mm-hmm. So the door is about a third of the way back on the plane, and you get on, and it seemed like some people were directed to the left, and most of us are directed to the right. Now, we all had coach class tickets, but their coach seemed to be a little bit better than our coach. So, got to see what East Berlin looked like from the other side. In fact, I've never seen West Berlin, only the east side.
What was that like?
Very interesting. Although they had a going economy, they still had. If you went down alleyways, there were still places in the building where shells had hit. Mm-hmm. You could still see damage from World War II. Their economy was very skewed. They wanted to guarantee people jobs, and one of the ways they guaranteed people jobs. If you couldn't work for anything else, you could work either in the coal mines or producing coke to burn. And so energy was almost free. There was a little charge for it, but not much. Mm-hmm. Well, in one of our tours that we had one afternoon, they showed us these whole area, many square blocks of apartment buildings that were being refurbished. And basically they were tearing them down to the walls and totally redoing them. And we were very impressed with the work they were doing, nice work and everything. And one of the things we noticed was there was no insulation being put into the walls. Now, it snows in East Berlin in the wintertime. It's cold there. The reason they were not putting any insulation in the walls is because it wasn't economical. It wasn't economical, because of this virtual free supply of coal and coke. And it totally skewed their economy. And after the wall came down, and after, you know, maybe a year had passed, I got to thinking about those poor people that got those apartments. Mm-hmm. Now they had to pay market going rates for energy the same as they did in West Berlin. And it is nice brand new houses with not a drop of insulation in the walls. So it's a kind of example of how sometimes the, you know, government policies can skew the economics. And from the typical East German, it probably looked normal. It's the way it had been ever since the end of World War II, probably. But it was totally skewed. Mm-hmm. But I've had opportunities to go to England several times, sometimes on research studies, sometimes on to attend meetings. Mm-hmm. When they were forming their building codes for Europe, foreigners, countries that are not in the Union were not allowed to attend some of those meetings. Mm-hmm. But they would have certain kinds of meetings we could attend. And so we would try to attend to see what they were talking about. We'd also try to explain to them what we knew about wood as a way of inputting into what they were doing. And one of the things this did was help prevent technical trade barriers. I mean, if a country just puts a ban on products from your country, then you'll be taken to the appropriate world organization and there'll be all kinds of hassles and so forth. So an easier way of accomplishing the same thing is to claim that the other country's product can't meet your technical requirements. In a lot of these countries, the research that goes on is done by a federal lab. And the federal lab may make the final decisions on things, unlike the United States. And in some countries, they didn't recognize the authority, the input of a university professor, of a technical person. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you almost had to be from a federal lab before they paid any attention to you. But it was good, got to meet a lot of really nice people. Mm-hmm. I've been to Portugal, to Finland, to Sweden. Although the foreign travel was not predominantly what I did, I did have a chance to do some travel out of the country, and a lot of travel to Canada. That almost, until we got interested in more security, you know, travel across the border to Canada was almost like going to another state. Mm-hmm. Maybe California, where they check you for pests and anything you might bring in your car. But anyway. So that was, sort of a side benefit of working here. Mm-hmm. It was the opportunity to go out. I would not want to travel all of the time. Mm-hmm. And most of the travel would be in the summertime. Most of our studies would be in the summertime. But, you go out for a couple of times in the summer for 1 or 2 weeks at a time and bring back your specimens that you can analyze and so forth later. Mm-hmm. It's kind of nice to get out. You know, it's nice to be in a mill without having to work there and the noise and the dirt and so forth.
When you did do international travel, did you get a sense of the international community's perception of the lab?
Yes.
And the Forest Service in general?
The people I dealt with probably don't, most of them, the Canadians would be an exception. They don't really have an impression of the Forest Service. This laboratory was one of the original labs that worked on wood from a technical point of view. And some of the early grading and property assignment procedures that were developed here were adopted by other countries. And the kinds of people we dealt with were well aware of the lab. Sometimes they had a bias against us. When I first came to the lab, you were not allowed to do much international travel, except as kind of a reward. In some of these meetings, particularly the meetings with the, as I was describing, for the European effort, They may have meetings at least once a year, sometimes twice a year. And these are the kinds of meetings where you're actually discussing technical issues, not just presenting a paper. And so it's important to have a continuing presence. Well, there were some people in Europe that were older and from the days when the lab didn't go over very much that I think felt a little slighted, that we were ignoring them or something. Mm-hmm. And so we sometimes get a little of that bias too. But in general, you know, it was fine. We learned a lot of good stuff from them. I think they learned some things from us.
I'd like to go back to kind of, you mentioned doing collaborative work when you went to other places throughout the country working with universities.
Yes.
Did you get a chance to work closely with people here at UW-Madison, and what was that kind of like if you did that?
Yes, we did do some work here with UW-Madison. In engineering area, this often meant we were working with somebody in, let's say, civil engineering or something. I think the forestry department at UW might have been hindered a little bit over the years because we were here. Mm-hmm. and we have a long history of teaching courses there and giving short courses and things there. But I think because of that, they've not traditionally gotten very strong in the wood utilization area. They've had some nice people there occasionally, but they may only have one or something. So often when we were cooperating in the kind of area I was in, we were working with one of the engineering departments. Sometimes it was ag engineering, sometimes civil engineering, sometimes chemical engineering. And there was a good opportunity to have cooperative students from UW. Mm-hmm. We had a lot of cooperative students from other parts of the country too, but just because of the closeness, we could have a student who would actually work here during the school year, mm-hmm. not just in the summer. Whereas, generally speaking, a student from, let's say, Idaho could come here perhaps for the summer, but was not likely to be here any of the other times. Mm-hmm. So from that point of view, we probably had more students here over the course of that period. These were not always related to a project we had over there. And sometimes if the student worked out real well for us and they were going to be around a while, you know, this might be sort of a continuing relationship. I think we had one student almost 4 years.
Wow.
Most of the time in the summer, and to what degree they were able to work during the school year.
Mm-hmm.
Just before I became a project leader, we actually hired one of the students who'd worked for us for two or three summers, a fellow named Dave Crutchman, who's still here. Eventually I became a project leader, became his boss. And so it also has occasionally provided some opportunities for hire. Now we've mm-hmm. we've obviously hired people not from UW also, but sometimes in one summer, especially if you get a student at a lower grade level,
mm-hmm.
They get put on a lot of fairly menial work, and it's not until, you know, they get up to maybe a junior level or something that you can begin to utilize some of their technical skills. And so sometimes for students from other parts of the country, we might not have the opportunity to see them at that level. So. But we've always had a good relationship with the University of Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that's one of the reasons the lab is in Wisconsin, because of their emphasis in the beginning and continuing on solving practical problems, not just mm-hmm. academic problems. So.
Well, would you like to maybe say a little bit more about being a project leader and maybe a little bit about the people that you work for you?
Or with me.
Or with you, or?
I never actually technically viewed my employees as employees. Mm-hmm. More like perhaps the department chairman looks at his faculty. Mm-hmm. Yes, I was the one I had to sign for their trips and so forth. Mm-hmm. But and until the last few years, when our numbers of employees started to get quite small, our projects, individual projects, were never very large. I think when I first came, we might have had 12 people in the 12 scientists in the project. Mm-hmm. And we probably got down to the point we maybe had five. Mm-hmm. And then they started consolidating. And so the numbers grew. Well, that was nice because we sometimes didn't have to hold formal meetings. I mean, mm-hmm. we'd hold a meeting because we all got together in the back hallway and discussed something, or if it was something very specific to something one particular scientist was doing, mm-hmm. you know, we could just talk with that person. And so that was always, to me, a very nice thing. I have worked in big companies. The company I worked for in Canada was a fairly large company. For the wood industry at the time. I had been in the military. Volume, in terms of size, forces a lot of formalized things because you can't get anything done otherwise. Mm-hmm. The hindrance is that it begins to make things less personal and so forth. And so I always sort of appreciated that. Like any place, there's people that you know, you get to like, that'll do anything for you. There's people that you respect, but they're kind of unique. The assistant director that I reported to when I first came to the lab was a fellow named Billy Bohannon. Billy was his legal name. And Billy had a nice career as a engineer, and then went into administration maybe a third of the way through his career, and spent the rest of his career in administration. Now, if you'd like to know something about Billy, I can probably tell you about Billy in about three things. He wore cowboy boots all the time. He might have a suit on, but he had cowboy boots. Imagine a combination of Maverick and Donald Trump. Put those together and you have Billy Bohannon. And for his day, he did a lot to advance the laboratory. He worked well with industry and so forth. He would not survive in today's environment. things were different in his day, but he was, you know, today would be viewed It's fairly dictatorial. Mm-hmm. Sometimes he was vindictive. On the other hand, you never went into a review with him that he didn't know exactly what you already had done. We would have to meet at least once and sometimes twice a year. And, you know, the 12 scientists in the project would all sit down with him and he'd go through all of our studies. Well, if it was an ongoing study, he remembered your objectives. He knew what you told him the last time. And all he wanted to know was what's different since then. Mm-hmm. And you better not try to tell him something that you didn't tell him last time. Change the story on him because he'd remember. So he was one of the sort of the unique people. Mm-hmm. I got along with Billy, but some people didn't, and I could understand why. James Evans, who's a statistician here, came about a year after I did, and he was assigned to work on this $7 million 10-year program, the in-grade testing program. James is still here, and I was very impressed with James. He's probably one of the best consulting statisticians I have ever seen. He was a faculty member at the University of Kentucky before he came here, and he and I did lots of trips together. We go to lots of meetings. And these are planning kinds of meetings, so you'd work all day and some question would kind of come up that needed to be answered by the next morning. James and I spent a lot of all nights, you know, working all night in order to have something ready to present to the group the next morning. And so, you know, you kind of, it's not something you want to repeat. On the other hand, it's, you know, something you kind of remember. I remember going with James to a meeting in Vancouver, British Columbia. The Canadians were part of this group for most of its existence. And James and I had been to Vancouver a time or two, but we weren't very familiar with the city. And we were going up, and it was one of those times when budgets were tighter, and we decided we would save some money for the government, and we'd share a room. No problem. We, you know, had done that sometimes before when we needed to. So we go up, and we shared a room, and came down, and there was a restaurant down on the bottom floor of this building, and then we had to catch a bus over to the lab for a meeting. So we're having breakfast. It suddenly became obvious to us we were in the gay part of Vancouver. The guy at the hotel desk probably figured we fit right in, you know. We have a lot of good technicians at the lab, still do. Guys that work hard, pay attention to what they're doing, very conscientious. One of the fellows that stands out is dead now, but a fellow named Roy Traver. Roy was a great big hulking guy. I mean, not quite as big as you know, Dan Blocker or somebody, Arnold Schwarzenegger, but a big hulking guy, really nice personality. Scared to death looking at him, and as soon as you talk to him, you know. And he was married to a small Korean lady. And he had a little bit of a problem with eating, and so she had him on a diet, and particularly a Korean diet. And he had more kimchi than he probably wanted to think about. And he really liked some of our trips. I remember going on a two-week mill study to southern Georgia in August. I mean, it was hot. We hoped it would rain so it would lower the humidity. But and again, we would show up at the mill at 7 in the morning and usually quit about 5:30 in the evening. The mill was out. There was no place really to eat, so we'd had the place we were staying fix us up a lunch, and so we'd take off on an hour to eat lunch right at the mill. And there wasn't many places to eat in town where we were staying either, but there was one very nice place, and it served everything family style. So they had counters all around the room, and you'd go pick out whatever it is you wanted to eat, and then you go sit at a table and you'd eat. And Roy was in seventh heaven. He could just have anything he wanted. Nobody told him, you know, what he could eat or couldn't, except he made us swear we'd never tell his wife what he was eating. And one of the things that they had it a few times was alligator tail in it. And Roy got so he loved alligator tail.
What's that taste like?
I don't know. It's a nice tasting meat. It tastes like alligator tail. Maybe some of the rest of the alligator tastes good too, but you know, the tail's a big muscle, so. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they'd have it there in a sauce, like a spaghetti sort of sauce. Sometimes it was fried in lots of different ways. And in a lot of these studies, we'd cooperate. The Forest Service has regional research labs also. In that case, there was one, he's still there, in Athens, Georgia. And there was a group of people from there that came down, and they were working on some different aspects of the same study. And so, you know, there might be, on any given day, there might be 15 of us there all working together on some of that. And so it was a nice opportunity, too, to actually work with other researchers in the Forest Service. Often they have really more expertise than we do in how the tree grows, things that might affect its properties and so forth. We may have more engineering expertise in what happens to it after you start to grade it and then in use. It's almost always better to know both parts of that. Well, by cooperating with them, we could get both parts of that knowledge. We do the same thing with the research station in Portland, Oregon, the Pacific Northwest Station, mm-hmm. when we'd work out there. Some of our co-op studies with universities would involve us, the Forest Products Lab, the Pacific Northwest Station, and let's say the University of Idaho or a group in Alaska or something. It's expensive to travel to some of these places, and So besides gaining the knowledge, then if you got somebody out there that can sort of continue the more mundane parts of that. I remember going on the study with a person. There were two scientists that went out, and a lady who was at that time was my statistical assistant. And it's always good to have some of those folks go out and see how the data is collected. They have a much better feel for the study, and mm-hmm. when they're analyzing the numbers, they're more likely to recognize there's a problem and so forth. So this lady's name is Pam Bird. She's now secretary mm-hmm. for the unit that I was in charge of before I retired. And we've been out in Hayfork, California. Hayfork, the town of Hayfork, is perhaps 400 people, if you count the greater area. And there's almost no place to stay there. So we had to stay over a little town called Weaverville, which almost burned down about 2 years ago in a forest fire. But anyway, it came right up to their high school, and they managed to stop it. And we were out there. I was out there 3 weeks. She was out there for two. But every day we had about an hour drive to get back to our hotel. Mm-hmm. Well, this was a Friday, and we were working kind of late, and we found out that a lot of the locals were taking a Forest Service road over the mountain a different way. Mm-hmm. And it probably wasn't any quicker. It was shorter, but you couldn't go as fast. And so we thought, you know, for something different, we'd do that. So I don't know how many thousand feet we were up. We were something like 14,000 feet, maybe. Oh, wow. Maybe 12. But yeah, so we're going up. We get to the top of the mountain. We have a flat. Okay. We're sitting there, and it's probably, if you walk downhill back to where we came, mm-hmm. It was probably an hour and a half walk. We'd never been over the other side, so we had no idea what it was that way. Mm-hmm. And it's late enough, because by now it's like 6 o'clock in the evening. There's all the locals that were using that road weren't going to be there, and the Forest Service folks weren't likely to be there either. So I took some pictures of us changing a tire up there. We didn't manage to get the tire changed, did manage to get off the mountain. I almost hate to mention people's names, because I've known so many good people here and at universities and in the industry that it's, you know, you're afraid you won't mention somebody. It's really been a good group of people. And one of the things I can say about my time here, and I would hope anybody can say this about wherever they work, I think I worked here for the best 27-year period in the Forest Products Lab's history. Not that there might not have liked it before or after, but I mean, every job since I've been a university professor, worked in industry, and worked here, I know that every job has things you don't like, and there's, you know, BS you have to put up with, and so forth. But I think the Forest Products Lab has been a great place. I think I've been able to have much more impact on wood utilization, have more of my stuff used by engineers than any place I could have been. More so than when I did work for research and private industry. There you either get pretty good support for a project or you're not allowed to do it at all. And of course, they only want to use the product themselves. They don't let somebody else use it. Mm-hmm. But the reputation, the contacts, the fact that you had a good core group of people in a variety of disciplines here and in UW close meant that to me this was just a great place to work. Mm-hmm. I couldn't have picked a better place, I think.
So kind of leading into that, what made you decide to retire? Was that just your time or?
Yes, all of the above. It was about the time that I had sort of thought about retiring. I hadn't thought about retiring too much until about 5 years earlier when one of my employees was retiring. And although at one time the retirement system was explained to me, that didn't mean I kind of remembered it. And I didn't realize I was getting close to the point I could retire. And that started me to think about it. And then as it got closer, as I said, the budget started getting very tight, and we started downsizing. Now, in the federal government, every time, every 5 years, you would have to go through a whole planning procedure to decide, what research you're going to be doing for the next 5 years, mm-hmm. on a fairly broad scope. And then you focus down on more specific projects underneath that. Now, that can change as you go along, but you have this plan, and that has to be approved by the Washington office. It gets sent out to the industry, it gets sent out to universities, we get comments on it, and so forth. It's a big deal. Mm-hmm. Wipes out, if you're the person in charge of writing it, it wipes out about 6 months of your time, mostly. I did do that reorganization. I did it just as part of the normal 5-year plan. A year later, they closed out the group that had concentrated exclusively on structures, moved those people into my group. So we had to go through a planning process to integrate them into our plans, because they hadn't gotten around to their five-year date wasn't up yet. Mm-hmm. And then about a year after that, I got all of another project and part of some others. It looked like I was going to do it again. Well, after a while, I mean, I'm a person who probably was more of a interested more in the research than the administrative part. I did the administrative part, but it wasn't something that I particularly wanted to do. Mm-hmm. So I kind of didn't want to have to do this again. Besides that, I knew that even if I did do it again, I probably wouldn't be here more than a year or two. And I might as well... It would be better if the people that were going to still be here did the planning than me. And then they came through and they wanted to reduce the number of employees, so they offered economic incentive to retire. And I thought, hey, this is about the time I was thinking about retiring anyway. If I retire now, I don't have to go through all of this planning and stuff with the reorganization. And I have a little money to ease the transition into retirement, because mm-hmm. for about a month you don't have a lot of income until you start your annuity starts. Mm-hmm. So the timing was good.
And what year did you actually retire then?
I retired in May 2 years ago, so that's May of 06. And I had some things that I wanted to spend some more time on, not work-related. I was never one of these people whose entire life was work. I always had a life outside of work anyway. I'm interested in genealogy, and I'd done a little of that over the years, but, I couldn't devote a lot of time to it. Mm-hmm. My wife and I had built a new house. There's a lot of landscaping needed to be done, all kinds of work needed to be done. Mm-hmm. And I just had a number of other things I wanted to do, too. Now, I've continued. I'm still writing papers. I still have some studies that I'm analyzing data for, and I'm still a cooperator with particularly with Professor Gorman on some ongoing studies. Those will phase out. That's an area, for example, that I knew that Dave Crutchman would also, because he was in a more or less related field that I was doing, and so I started getting Dave involved, and so I'll phase out, and Dave is phasing in. So. But it was a good time for me, mm-hmm. I thought.
Now, you've mentioned a couple of times the downsizing towards the end of your career.
Yep.
Do you know what kind of sparked that?
Budgets. Mm-hmm. And I think this is not unique to this particular time period. I've written a number of what we call technical history articles in my field. For example, the lab was expanded greatly during World War I. Wood was one of the defense materials for World War I. And at the end of World War and during World War I, they ran three shifts a day here. I'm not sure I know exactly how they did that. Did you start a project, work on it for 8 hours, somebody took it over, or was he doing something different and you picked it up the next day? I don't know how they did that. But anyway, at the end of World War I, their budgets went way, way down. And I've seen, they would look at areas they can continue to work on, so they continue to get some support. Research on wooden airplane propellers was one of those, mm-hmm. because they knew that, that not only was the military interested in that, but civilian airlines were also. I think for a lot of government organizations, things ebb and flow depending on what the problem is, depending on what the overall economy of the country is. When I first came here in 79, budgets, at least in the Forest Service, were relatively good. Then came the first oil crisis, mm-hmm. and budgets went downhill a lot, and we did some downsizing, and then it recovered, and we came back out. So I think we're also switching modes, for better or worse. There's advantages both ways, since I've been on both sides of the fence. We're switching more from a, what I'll call sort of a national lab mode, where you have some overall sets of objectives that are agreed upon in a very formalized way. Perhaps over 50% of your budget is coming from the federal government. That doesn't mean you don't take in other money. We're switching more over to the university system, where almost all of your actual operating money has to come from grants. You're having to write grants and so forth. There's good and bad. although this lab has helped out some of the big companies of the United States, Weyerhaeuser can get along just fine without us. They have some of their own research people. They can tool that up or down depending on how they want. The people that we help more are the medium size and smaller companies, the towns, the people, and in a lot of things dealing with engineering codes and so forth, we are the independent advice. There's a whole system that I won't even bother to explain to you as to how you get lumber properties approved in the United States. And we have been since their inception. They're technical advisor. We do not vote. We can make input or comments, and they meet quarterly. And so if industry wants to get some new procedure approved or something, it's sent for us for comments. Mm-hmm. We don't approve it. They do. In that respect, we represent the Department of Agriculture, not the Forest Service, mm-hmm. not the lab. mm-hmm. And we do that sort of thing for lots of codes and standards organizations, things mm-hmm. that deal in our areas. Things where it gets so technical that most people wouldn't even want to try to understand it. Mm-hmm. In areas where often university faculty aren't going to want to spend that time to do it. It requires historical knowledge. as well, but is critical to the smooth functioning of the economy in the forest industry. We get calls sometimes, let's say for the National Transportation Safety Board. If there is an accident of some sort that involves wood, there still are wooden planes. Most of those now are classified as experimental, but sometimes they crash. Mm-hmm. And if there's something unusual about it, we will get called. Sometimes we go to wherever it was. usually not to look at the crash itself, but to look at the wooden members and comment on them. Sometimes there have been things that involve railroads. I got called once to look at some material. In this case, they sent the material to me after some lengthy phone conversations and letter exchanges. But there were wooden rails on the side of a flat car that were holding in logs. They broke, and some people got killed. And they wanted to know, was there a problem from a wood perspective? They would look at the other aspects of it. And so we get called in on sorts of that thing. So we, in fact, Dave Cressman works for me as one of two people that got called when a lady got killed in Sauk County. She fell out of a tree. Turns out she was on drugs, and who knows why she was in the tree. But they wanted to know, and they found her body laying underneath the tree with some broken limbs, and they wanted to know whether, you know, the wood fatty was consistent of somebody falling out of a tree. So they wanted to make sure that somebody didn't fake her falling out of a tree. So it's always something interesting here.
What's one of the most interesting cases that you've heard of?
Oh, not necessarily the most important case. Sometimes the questions that you get turn out to be interesting. Mm-hmm. At least half the questions we get are things that we already know, but they don't, so we help them out by telling them. But one of the most interesting questions I ever got was a lady called up once and said she and her husband had bought an old church, and they were going to renovate it for a house. And they'd owned it for several years, and they hadn't done anything much to it yet, but now they're getting ready to start actually doing the work. So they went in, and in the process, they began to smell some odors. And they finally located that there was bat guana in the attic. And their question was, does bat guana affect the properties of wood? I had done some work for my master's degree on the effect of anhydrous ammonia on wood properties, so I got the question. So I talked to her, and she told me a little bit about the situation and so forth. And then I asked her, well, how much is up there? Oh, she said she didn't know, but it was probably foot and a half deep. I said, your problem is that it's not going to have any effect on the mechanical properties, but you're not ever going to get the odor out of that wood.
Oh, my goodness.
So that's probably one of the most unusual questions I've ever gotten.
Well, we're at a little bit over an hour, and I guess I don't have... We covered most of the questions that I had, but if you have any other stories or memories of people, places, things that you would like to add...
Oh, I could go on for hours, and you probably don't want me to do that. Oh, I think I've covered in sort of a general way enough things.
Okay.
I could list people forever.